Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Philbrook Museum of Art opened a new show devoted to the work of American modernist painter Max Weber. This is the first exhibit to feature Weber's work in over 20 years, and it's impressive for several reasons. First, the quality of the artistic work displayed, and the fact that Philbrook organized this show, and this is the only venue for it, despite not owning a single work by the artist. Models and Muses, Max Weber and the Figure, is a survey exhibit of 40 years of the artist's work featuring the human form. Over the course of the show, you'll see vestiges of post-impressionism, fauvism, cubism. Of course, he was a specialist in cubism, social realism, and the beginnings of abstract expressionism. As Weber was one of the first artists to bring European 20th century modernism to American art. My guest today is Philbrook's chief curator and curator of American art, Catherine Whitney, who is also the curator and organizer of the show that continues on display through February 3rd. Models and Muses, Max Weber and the Figure is on display at Philbrook. Catherine Whitney is my guest. Catherine Whitney, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us, and thank you for such a great show.
Well, thank you for saying that. We're thrilled with it and hope as many people as possible can view it.
Now, when we think of Philbrook putting on a show, we usually think of Philbrook having some sort of collection involved with the show. This is probably a first for Philbrook, and at least in a number of years, where you're originating a show that will only show here, in which really you don't have any artwork by Max Weber, the artist.
We don't have any works in our permanent collection by Weber yet, but this was really an opportunity for us to bring fine examples of early American modernism to Tulsa and to the museum and really sort of tell the story of early American modernism from about 1910 to 1950 through this one artist's career who really reflected and in some cases anticipated a lot of the movements of the first half of the 20th century.
Now, Max Weber is probably not a household name among American artists from mm-hmm. this period. He's known to the Cognosi, but he had an enormous influence on a lot of artists because he's probably one of the first American artists to reflect European modernism in American art.
That's right. He was sort of a visual ambassador of French modernism to America. He was in Paris from about fall 1905 to late 1908, and he came back to the American shores in 1909 and really introduced cubism to America, was one of the first cubists, and is probably what he's known most for. And then with that, he introduced a lot of what was popular in Paris and among the avant-garde there to American audiences. And then his career really evolved and his styles evolved throughout his 50-year career.
And this whole period was a sort of a search for artists in which, you know, fauvism to cubism to neoclassicalism to, you know, I mean, there was all these isms that mm-hmm. came about in this period where you found artists trying new ways to express themselves. And Weber's there every step of the way. He's in cubism. In the 20s, he's kind of got this, what really became his style, I think, for the most part. It's sort of these very much, in this case, figures, which is the focus of the show. But the figures are, they're very flat and they're very amorphous, I guess that's the way I would describe it. You know, he's kind of moving towards abstraction ever so slightly. But you can see he's a figurative at his heart.
He is. And the point of the show, I mean, he did still life, he did abstraction, he did landscape throughout his whole career. But the figure, he was really very attached to the figure, except for a very few years in the mid-1910s when he exclusively sort of treated scenes of the city of New York and this kind of cubist futurist interpretations that were very dynamic. But from about 1900 to the early 50s, he really was very engaged with the figure. So this exhibition looks at his stylistic evolutions through the figure. It's also interesting that you were sort of struggling to describe his work, especially in the 20s, because he does throughout his figural compositions have these almost sort of vague, evocative narratives that are really hard to pinpoint. And Percy North, who is the premier Weber scholar, has been working on him for 40 years, who came during the opening weekend and gave a great lecture. It is also a contributing essayist for our catalog. She and I have had these conversations about what is going on, and they're really engaging and mysterious, and they've got a lot of feeling and humanity, but they're very hard to articulate. They're very beautiful.
Well, you know, in the 1920s, there's also, you can see where he's kind of going back to classical themes, but he's doing them in a totally modern way.
Right, right.
And I guess he was I always like to see an artist that's always searching for the next thing, and this seems to be a big part of his work.
Right. His first decade or so, he was really almost obsessively focused on stylistic innovation, on progressive painting techniques, like you said, cubism, fauvism, futurism, and how to paint the exotic, how to paint the dynamic. And Through the Figure is a great way to illustrate how he explored these very abstract aesthetic and scientific theories that were very popular at the time with him in science, with the Stieglitz Circle artists from the turn of the century. And then something happens around 1916, or a number of things happen in his personal life. He gets married, both parents die, the U.S. is in and out of World War I, and his approach to the figure really changes, I think, because of these biographical factors. And things get a little bit more human-based. You know, it's not so much about style. It's about humanism, about human interaction. His Orthodox Jewish heritage comes into play. He starts exploring these themes of intimate interiors and Jewish themes, which he'll explore throughout his career and became quite known for. So it really is almost more a personalization of his work.
There's also, you see, the color palette at the beginning of the show is far more colorful than as his art progressed, especially during the 20s and 30s. Was this a time of pessimism? Because when you look at the figures of that time, you know, there's a section of the show that looks at social commentary, which is late 1930s, when things were actually looking better.
Right.
And you know, he's showing factory workers. And these are not the heroic factory workers that you think of WPA art and,
right,
and European art of this time. These are beaten down people just on the verge.
Right.
It seems like there's a very pessimistic note to the painting. Was that reflected in his own life?
I think what these reflect is a sympathy for his situation, his fellow artist situation. I mean, he wasn't, as his daughter Joy said in a documentary video, he wasn't selling many paintings at this time. And a lot of people were walking around jobless, hungry, frustrated, penniless, you know, depressed and angry. And I think Weber channeled that frustration and sympathy and empathy into his painting. And so you get this very dark, drippy, gritty kind of mottled figures in these really expressive environments. There's kind of looming factories in the background, and you see these, not mobs, but groups of sort of forlorn, you know, laborers.
Right. And the way he does their faces is, in a way, it's very sort of abstract-y.
Right.
And it's just, you just see the weight of the world beating these people down.
Right. And I think he was, as I said, he was sympathetic, he was empathetic, and he became very socially and politically engaged at this time. He was starting really to become nationally acclaimed. And in 1936, he was nominated as the first chairman of the American Artists Congress. And this was a left-wing organization that basically fought for artists' rights and rights for people around the world. They were anti-fascist, you know, against the Nazi Party, and were really trying to get more funds and support for artists and against censorship. So I think these paintings really reflect his real-life involvement in society and in politics.
My guest today is Catherine Whitney, the chief curator and curator of American art at Philbrook Museum, and the person who put together this incredible show, Models and Muses, Max Weber and the Figure, which is on display through February 3rd. And you're looking at donations from the Hirshhorn, the Museum of Modern Art.
Let me just say loans. I wish they were donations.
Oh, excuse me.
And we are open to donations, by the way.
Loans, Crystal Bridges. Yeah. I mean, very big institutions. And as well as a couple of galleries that are contributing a lot of these things. And yet, you know, Philbrook, that's kind of unheard of, that a museum will loan these things without a focus of the museum itself.
Well, I think a number of things happened. One was I came to the museum about 2 years ago and had personal and professional connection to the Max Weber estate. I know the artist's daughter. And when I got here, our director, Rand Suffolk, really encouraged that, and he was very supportive and excited about it. And so we kind of started there and got the support from the estate to do the show. So about a third of the works, maybe a little less, are from the artist's daughter as well as the representative of the Weber Estate, which is the Gerald Peters Gallery in New York. So with the daughter's support, we wrote to a lot of institutions. We sort of had to figure out where they were. And Rand wrote a good letter. And, you know, Philbrook is very biased, of course. But I think we're doing great things. And I think we're starting to get not only regional but national recognition. And so I think people were excited about the idea. And things just sort of came together.
I guess nobody's put together a big Max Weber show in a while.
That was another thing. There hasn't been a museum survey of the artist's career in 20 years. And while you said a lot of people sort of know his name, not everybody out of the art field knows who he was, but there is a name recognition there. And he has been very prominently featured in a lot of major exhibitions in the last 10 years on American Cubism, on Modernism and Picasso in American art. You know, his acknowledgement is there or his reputation is there in the museum field, but a monographic survey really hasn't been done. And I think when museums got this letter, they realized, hey, that's a good idea. Let's do that. So,
yeah. Well, that's great.
They were very supportive.
Well, let's talk about some of the big pieces in the show. Mm-hmm. One of the first pieces in the show, it's called La Parisienne. Mm-hmm. It's a very sumptuous nude that looks like it's out of like a Yavlevsky or perhaps a Matisse,
right.
Really.
Matisse, Modigliani.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, right. It has that look to it. It's an incredible little piece that opens the show.
Right.
And from there you go to start seeing how he's influenced by Cubism and Fauvism at first. There's a little Fauvist called the Apollo in Matisse studio. And I guess he was studying with Matisse?
He was. Yeah, there are two early nudes from 1907, and they're much more lyrical and elegant. And as you say, they definitely reflect Matisse, and there are sort of these quiet contemporary women in these sort of bare interiors. They're very lovely, a little bit more, as I said, very calm and tranquil. And then that piece from 1908 that you mentioned, the Apollo in Matisse's studio, indeed reflects the fact that Weber took drawing instruction in a small class of only 8 to 10 students with Henri Matisse actually coming in and critiquing. And it was in an old unoccupied convent. And the students actually purchased a plaster cast of a copy of the Apollo Belvedere. And so they did these life studies from that plaster cast, as was very popular for art students to do at the turn of the century and earlier. And so you really see Weber applying this very revolutionary color theory that Matisse became known for, which was just sort of unmodulated chunks of color. You see bright lavender and pink next to green, and it's this very kind of emotive and dynamic energy and color that talks more about the color and the geometries than it does necessarily about.
Yeah, they're actually blocks realism. Of color in
yeah.
this piece, and that was very popular in
right.
that time.
Right.
But you can see that he doesn't really totally. I mean, maybe there are other pieces that do reflect this, but this piece is a little more muted than you would expect of Fauvism. And of course, within a year, he's looking ahead to Cubism.
Right, right. Yeah, Weber, it's almost like he's tasting these things, like little tapas of styles, you know? And he's like, okay, I've tasted that. I like that. What's next? And so he really does. He admires, he visits Matisse, he studies under Matisse, he admires and meets Picasso very much. He becomes very friendly with this crazy, almost sort of naive artist in Paris, Henri Rousseau, who many people might not know the name, but they probably are very familiar with his sort of jungle-like landscapes
right.
of the woman reclining on the Victorian couch with the monkeys and the overgrown foliage around her. And Rousseau became Weber's sort of surrogate father. And Weber wrote in his oral histories how he would go to Rousseau's studio and get this sense of calm and peace. And I think he got this wild sense of imagination.
That's interesting. They're so close because you'd see very little connections in their work at
right,
all.
Right. But later that piece, Summer 1909, that comes to us from the Smithsonian American Art Museum, which is a wonderful, wonderful, outstanding piece to have here in Tulsa, you start to see that very strong color and that very kind of wild foliage in the forest. So
yeah, in the background behind
yes.
these three women. And this is, I think this was really interesting because there are three trios of female nudes, mm-hmm. the three paintings of three women, nude women, from about 1909 to 1910. And you can start seeing the cubism effect, And what was the interest in the three women? Was that a
three
theme?
Three muses. Models and muses, right? Like you were talking about La Parisienne is probably a model that he hired in the studio. Then you have these muses that are these very kind of exotic, almost Picasso-esque, very much quotes of Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, a painting he actually saw in Picasso's studio around 1907, 1908 in Paris. Complete with the arm thrown behind the head and lounging in nature. There are a couple of references to Matisse's Blue Nude with the kind of rolling forms of the hips and things like that. So you have these women sort of luxuriating in the wilds of nature. And then he starts to get almost obsessed with furthering cubism, not just kind of this exotic, dreamlike, almost quote-unquote primitivizing of the form, but also an interest in showing dynamic movement and how we can explore cubism and introduce it to the United States by showing multiple views. There's one beautiful piece of women in trees where there's one woman, very kind of ghost-like woman, but it looks like multiple muses in the forest. But it was probably meant to be one woman from multiple vantage points, which is an element of cubism. Mm-hmm. And then later he advances cubism further by fracturing form and showing, you know, the planes and getting the background to sort of merge with the figure and you get the whole surface.
One of the things I found was really interesting was his approach to cubism. You know, cubism can emphasize the grotesque, and he never does that. He's got a very sophisticated look to the way he would do that.
That's an interesting perspective. I never really thought of that, but... it's almost like cubism for him was joyous or dynamic. And as he introduces more fracturing and fragmentation, he often introduces more color too. And I think one thing that sets him apart from his European antecedents is color, because you think of Braque and Picasso and these analytical cubist pieces and you think of browns and grays and Weber really starts to introduce blues and yellows. And then as he starts to look at performance as a way to sort of, a subject for his cubist studies, he starts painting this energy around the figures dancing, and it's almost these colorful prismatic bands radiating out. So he's trying to show you, as he says, in plastic terms, something that a lot of the 20th century artists were fond of saying. He wants to physically show you what vibration and energy looks like.
Now, I saw that in that piece, The Dancer, which is one of the stunners of the show too. It has lots of colors, the yellows and the blues that you were talking about, and it's this dancer who is somewhat cubist, but it's also it's really showing motion.
Right.
Lots of motion.
Right. This sense of dynamic movement, I think, was sort of very interesting for him. Weber was also very much of an intellectual, and he was interested in atomic theory. He was interested in this popular theory at the time, the crystallization of form, and also something called the fourth dimension, which related back to a lot of early modernists who wanted to sort of show this transcendental energy in nature. And you think of his colleagues like O'Keefe and Arthur Dove and Marston Hartley, and they sort of spiritualized the American landscape or made these abstractions with these kind of throbbing, pulsating geometries and tried to find color and geometric equivalents for these nonverbal and maybe invisible forces in nature. And so Weber takes that in a slightly different route. He has the same kind of rhetoric he's playing with, like spiritual and intuitive and energetic, and he applies it to the figure and to motion. So I think that really sets him apart from his contemporaries.
How big of an influence was he on those early American modernists who had spent maybe a lesser degree in Europe or not at all at Europe? Because there are a number of pieces in the show which, when you look at the date, you go, well, this predates Marsden Hartley by a couple of years. And this looks like something Marsden and Hartley would use. This is a technique that he would use. Is that the case? Was he a big influence on a lot of these?
He was early on, I think. He and Alfred Stieglitz, who was one of the greatest champions of modern art in America early on and ended up being George O'Keefe's husband, Weber and Stieglitz formed a very intense but brief friendship around 1909, 1910 and kind of divorced, if you will, around 1911. But I think that Weber really helped Stieglitz come along and understand a lot of these very progressive ideas that he learned in Europe. And I've read that Hartley, Marston Hartley and Weber were in the back room of 291, which was Stieglitz's gallery, talking about the primitive, which was a very interesting concept to a lot of early American modernists. They would look at tribal arts, they would look at African art, they would look at Native American art, pre-Columbian art, and there was a sense that modern culture was very insincere and the expression very prosaic, and they wanted to kind of find a new energy and a new, quote-unquote, pure expression. So they looked to a lot of non-Western art forms and cultures, and a lot of them historic, and said, you know, how do they have this kind of expressive oomph? You know, how can we re-inject that pure expression and energy back into our artwork that has become way too cultured and way too refined? Like, let's get back to sort of the primal instincts of what makes things powerful.
And of course, that's a big tenet of modernism, is when you look at, say, the portrait. You know, the portrait was about making it as lifelike as possible, and all of a sudden in the 20th century, it's about, no, let's flatten this image. Let's lose that third dimension.
Right.
Let's put the plain image out there.
Right. Yeah. And you'll see that a lot in Weber. You'll see these almost mask-like faces that refer to Picasso and Picasso looking at African art. He's got these beautiful almond eyes early on that, you know, are they Egyptian? Are they Assyrian? You know, he was going to the Trocadero, which was a natural history museum in Paris, as was Marston Hartley around the same time, actually. Mm-hmm. And then he comes back to New York and visits the Natural History Museum in New York regularly. And he taught. He was an important teacher, and from 1914 to 1918, he taught art history and composition at the Clarence White School of Photography. And he really encouraged his students to look at the ancients, to look back at non-Western cultures, to really – he felt you could better understand the modern day by looking at what had come before.
A couple other standouts in this early period of the show, which we haven't talked about. One is The Bather, which is – I think it's an exquisite painting. It's from about 1913, mm-hmm. and it's, I would call it almost beveled cubism. It's a woman in the, I assume in the shower, because it looks like, you know, the water is cascading down. I mean, that's how I see it. And there are multiple arms that are going up. There's arms in the hair, there's arms across the body, arms at the side. And it's just really, I think it's a really cool painting.
It was sort of a coup to get. I was very excited. That's from the Hirshhorn Museum at the Smithsonian. And it is a wonderful piece, and it's really probably Weber at his height of understanding analytic cubism and breaking up the form. And as we talked about, merging the form and the subject with the background so it all becomes sort of one big swirl and shift. And it's hard to enjoy hearing what you saw in it, because I haven't seen that, but now I'm going to have to go back.
Well, to me, it looks almost like it's beveled in a way.
Right,
you know? So anyway,
But the thing about cubism, with all those multiple planes shifting constantly, it's the whole surface is energized, and it's hard. You can't follow it like a maze. You can't start at the beginning and get out at the end.
But that whole idea of action too is important, because you said he was trying to depict action, and it looked like it was the act of bathing, because the hand, there was a hand in the hair, there's a hand across the body, like we're washing.
Right.
Yeah. So, and I want to mention another painting too is The Two Musicians, which, if at a distance, it looks like, wow, that's just like Picasso. But when you get closer, he had this very interesting way of doing the face, in which it's in some ways more grotesque, in other ways less grotesque than what you would expect to see with, you know, the two eyes on one side of the face, like Picasso. It was a very interesting perspective of how he did that.
That's a wonderful piece, and that's from the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And I think of those works as very whimsical, actually.
Yeah.
Grotesque in that the body parts and pieces are sort of jumbled up and put back in the wrong place, but very whimsical in that there's almost a sense of humor and joy to them. They're bright colors. They're very there's a lot of texture, and it almost looks like a collage, a painting, and there's a bass player as well as a piano keyboard player, but it's hard to pick out exactly what they're doing. And this was another thing that Weber played with in the 19-teens, this concept of a correspondence between the arts. He, you know, keep in mind that at this time, Impressionism was kind of radical. and academic painting was sort of the norm, and Impressionism was becoming popular.
And this was way out there.
This was wild. This was kind of ridiculous to a lot of critics and audiences. And so there was this idea that a lot of critics introduced to sort of help ease conservative audiences into an acceptance of abstraction, which was, let's compare it to music. Music was a very popular medium. People went out. It had a great market value. It was understood and accepted. And people said, let's interpret abstract art as if it were music, because it is a form of abstraction. And Weber, I think, really embraced this analogy. And being that he almost chose a career as a vocalist, so music was always a big part of his life. So I think he wanted to sort of equate abstract painting and the enjoyment of an abstract painting with the non-mimetic qualities of music and the enjoyment of the abstract nature of music.
My guest today is Catherine Whitney, the chief curator of Philbrook Museum of Art. Models and Muses, Max Weber and the Figure, is on display through February 3rd. It's one of the best shows I've seen in Tulsa in some time. Mm-hmm. And we're about out of time. I want to talk, you know, those faces that are part of the two musicians. It's interesting when you go to the last section of the show, and this is where he's under the influence of de Kooning, and you can see he's keeping the figure, but abstract expressionism is creeping into his work. The faces have this sort of connection between those early Cubist faces and what he's doing with the abstract expressionism. But I want to finish with four paintings from 1919 that you've put together, right together. It's interesting because it shows how Weber was really experimenting. There's a Red Cross nurse, which is totally figurative. And it felt like it was a commission of some sort having to do with the war relief or something.
Exactly. That's exactly okay. What it was.
So it's totally figurative. Next is one called The Conversation, very Cubist. There's a small little painting that you mentioned, the Jewish themes, the Sabbath, mm-hmm. in which he has this very skewed perspective.
Right. Very angular.
Yeah, very angular. And then A Girl with Comb, in which it's this very flat portraiture. And you see four very distinct styles within the same year.
Right.
I think that's a really cool statement for the artist.
Right. Yeah, 1919 was when he really kind of lost his Cubist grasp and started loosening it a lot. So you still see the Cubist influence in his figures, but it's not as radically fractured as the Bather that you mentioned. He starts, again, developing this interest in his Jewish heritage and Jewish themes. The Sabbath is obviously that. It's almost like he's still interested in this concept of the fourth dimension, but it's not so much a physical fourth dimension as it is sort of a cerebral or a mystical fourth dimension. So these figures, the interior is almost, you know, attenuated and angled and made very dramatic with these swashes of drapery and the sunlight coming through. And so you know they're having a probably a Sabbath discussion that's kind of turning a normal interior into sort of a mystical realm. So he's very interested in using these stylistic techniques to get at a more personal, human, or spiritual place, I think.
Yeah, well, it is a great show.
Thank you.
People should go out to Philbrook to see Models and Muses, Max Weber, and The Figure. It's on display through February 3rd. Catherine, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. It's been fun.
Catherine Whitney is the chief curator and curator of American art at the Philbrook Museum of Art, and also the curator for the new show, Models and Muses, Max Weber, and The Figure, an exhibit organized by Philbrook. It is exclusively at Philbrook through February 3rd. For details, visit philbrook.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent shows, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa, and then you can search for the subject you're looking for. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.